This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With the Middle East Peace Conference, President Bush has taken the next step in his vision of a new world order. But a new investigative piece in Mother Jones magazine says that the new world order has been built in part on an old secret military agreement between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. The article is by Scott Armstrong, founder of the National Security Archives, former Washington Post reporter, and co-author with Bob Woodward of The Brethren. According to Armstrong, the high-tech command, control, and communication center in Saudi Arabia that we used during the Gulf War was actually built over the past decade with high-tech weapon systems purchased by the Saudis from America through an agreement that kept the arrangement secret from the Congress and the public. The agreement gave the Saudis military power, and it gave the U.S. a military base to defend its oil interests. Armstrong first wrote about this arrangement in a 1981 Washington Post story headlined "Saudi AWACS, Just a Beginning of New Strategy." Armstrong says the secret military agreement dates back to the Carter administration.
In 1979, President Carter was faced with hostages seized in Iran. The Shah had been overthrown. He had Soviet troops moving into Afghanistan. The Persian Gulf was suddenly a hostile place for the United States. We were concerned about how we would meet Soviet force there, what we could do to get our hostages back, and we found that we had no way to get there. We needed to have bases, and we turned to the Saudis and said, "Can you help us out?" The Saudis said, "Well, if you treat us as equals to Israel, if you give us, really give us bases, really come in with a major system, we're willing to consider this." And gradually, over the course of the next year, we designed an extremely large, complicated, sophisticated system, similar to what we have in NATO, which the Saudis were willing to pay for and put in. That system was considered by the Reagan administration and taken to Congress by the Reagan administration under the guise of the so-called AWACS, the air warning defense planes that we sold in 1981. Those planes became a kind of Trojan horse for getting the rest of the system in. The planes were a $5.5 billion package. They actually only cost $110 million apiece. We sold them five. That's only $550 million. That other $4.9 billion was a secret arrangement, what is called a C-cubed-I, Command, Control, Communications, and Intelligence System, an elaborate high-tech air defense system capable of linking everything from Egypt to Pakistan, from the Soviet southern border to the Indian Ocean, up in one massive system. We got it through Congress without them recognizing what it was. They say the Defense Department got it through Congress without them recognizing what it was, and were then able to add pieces to it. Those pieces, through little agreements here and there along over 10 years, sometimes disagreements with the Saudis, and they went to the British or to other NATO allies to do part of it, have now amounted to what is a region-wide $200 billion system, of which they've paid for over $150 billion. Their allies and other U.S. investments in the region bring it to about $200 billion.
So you're saying that the AWACS deal was really a Trojan horse affair. We charged them several times more for the AWACS than the AWACS really cost. And that was a way for the Saudis to buy other military equipment from us without letting Congress know that it was happening, without Congress having to approve the other sales.
Congress was so inattentive to the AWACS sale that they looked at the $5.5 billion package and said, "Oh yes, that's for five AWACS planes." In fact, that was only 10% of the arrangement. The other 90% was for command and control systems for ground stations, for consoles and computer systems and wiring, things that were hardened against nuclear blast, the quality of NATO equipment, that Congress didn't notice. They didn't recognize that these weren't just a few spares or a little support equipment, but that actually the heart of the system was not AWACS, but the ground control facility that was going to be used to support it.
You know, I find it hard to believe that Congress could not notice that the cost of AWACS was inflated by several hundred percent. I mean,
It is incredible as it seems. When I went in to talk to John Glenn, the senator who was in charge of the opposition to the AWACS sale, and I said, "Senator, I'm confused. Let's do a little arithmetic. We're told that this AWACS package, there's a $5.5 billion package here. We're told that that's to sell five planes. An AWACS plane of the same type that we sold to the Shah of Iran a few years ago was going to cost $100 million. I'm told by the Air Force that it costs now $110 million. Five times $110 million is not $5.5 billion. Senator Glenn sat and made little notes on his hand as if he were doing the multiplication out and said, gee, you're right. What's that other $4.9 billion for? And turned to an aide who said, well, Senator, it's for ground support equipment and other things. I then explained my thesis of what it was about, because I'd heard it from an obscure Air Force general named Richard Secord at the time, who was in charge of the sale, and from some Saudi sources. And I explained to Senator Glenn that I believe this was a Trojan horse for a much larger system that they were putting through. And his aide said, yes, I think that's right. Senator Glenn said, well, actually, that makes more sense than the reason they gave us to sell it originally, because we can use it against the Soviets. He's continued to oppose the sale, but I think with much less enthusiasm. The sale lost by only two votes. The sale won by two votes, I should say. The effort to defeat it lost by only two votes. And I don't think the rest of Congress really appreciated what that sale was about.
But how could it be that they didn't do the math?
I've seen more remarkable things in Congress, but this ranks right up there, I think, with a failure to really attend to what the job's about. When they get into these high-tech issues, they don't really pay attention. And when somebody said, well, this is extra training and spares and whatnot, nobody was willing to say, well, wait a minute, how can 90% of it be for other support equipment, other spares, ground support stations? That doesn't make any sense. They just didn't do it.
What's your understanding of the agreement that went along with the sale and the construction of the military center?
The first agreement that under which the AWACS were sold was in February of 1981, and it was between an American general and a Saudi general because they didn't want to do it at a higher level. It was an oral understanding. They wanted to keep things at an oral level. It was eventually committed to paper, but it essentially said that in return for selling them the AWACS and the other support equipment, that we would be prepared to go in to defend Saudi Arabia. That agreement has grown. It has become more elaborate, more complicated, if you will, in the sense of what the equipment is and what our arrangements are, what we were willing to protect. On the other hand, it really amounts to a handshake, a gentleman's agreement. They've tried to avoid making it a treaty because they can't take it to Congress. So it's been really an understanding between George Bush and King Fahd, and before that, between Ronald Reagan and King Fahd, and before that, the predecessor king, King Khalid, and Jimmy Carter and President Reagan. And those oral agreements have taken place, have been negotiated between secretaries of defense, sometimes by generals. They've been a matter of gentlemen's agreements, and really have never fully been formalized.
Why couldn't the president take this to Congress? Why has it been kept a secret from Congress?
The feeling in the Pentagon and in the White House has been that if you took this to Congress, it would open up into the more basic question of, do we want to have a primary relationship with Saudi Arabia? How will this change our relationship with Israel? That supporters of Israel, who I think by most headcounts are the predominant number in Congress, at least in the Senate side, will vote against it, and the Saudis will be publicly humiliated. And they don't want to go forward with it. So as we've explained it to Saudi Arabia, if we go down the path of looking for a formal treaty, you have the opportunity of losing. The Saudis have said, no, let's not do that. Secondly, the Saudis can't have the public exposure in Saudi Arabia of the fact that they're totally dependent on the United States to defend the two holy mosques at Mecca and Medina. That's their job under Islamic law, and it is forbidden for the infidel, for a non-Islamic nation, to be the custodians of those holy mosques. And in some sense, that's what we would become if this were publicly known.
My guest is Scott Armstrong, founder of the National Security Archives and a former Washington Post reporter. We're talking about his cover story in the new issue of Mother Jones magazine. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott Armstrong. In the new issue of Mother Jones, he reports on a secret military arrangement between the U.S. and the Saudis that created a network of super bases in Saudi Arabia. How does the knowledge of how the United States and the Saudis collaborated on creating this enormous command and control center in Saudi Arabia, how does your knowledge of that change your interpretation of our motives for going to war against Iraq?
It's important to look back at the Gulf War for a number of reasons. Number one, we had a real interest in trying to get in there to test this system. We were much more able. I'm not saying we were looking for an opportunity to go to war, but we wanted to take advantage of this opportunity, I think, to show the Saudis that we were serious about backing them up, number one, but also that we were really prepared to take this system, which I guess you could compare the system to kind of a dehydrated system. You had American troops and fresh water. And it suddenly springs to life. It becomes kind of like it's like suddenly transporting NATO into the region. We wanted to. Our military was anxious to use it in the sense of bring it to life, not necessarily to fight, but showing that we could do it. But most important, it shows why we won so easily. The Iraqis were not simply outnumbered; they were not simply faced with more advanced or sophisticated weapons. In fact, in Saudi Arabia was a much more advanced system than they had themselves. For all of the discussion that the U.S. military had during that period about the Iraqi buildup and how powerful they were, the at least the top members of the U.S. military and the Department of Defense knew that we'd done something much stronger and something that was threatening the Iraqis. When the Iraqis complained, and if you look back, you'll find extensive complaints prior to their invasion of Kuwait, they were complaining not just about Kuwait, but that Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and the United States were threatening them. The Iraqis claimed that they were being threatened by exercises in the region with a possible invasion. I don't think that's true, but I think they did have good reason to be threatened. Lastly, if you look at how quickly we prevailed, it tells you just how powerful this system is, and that if we ever left the region, if we ever left this behind, this could become the centerpiece to perhaps a Saudi regime in different hands, a radical Islamic regime that was going to resist the United States, it could become something that we would really fear on the other side. If the Iraqis had had this, number one, we would not have gone in, and number two, had we gone in, we might not have done as well. We might even have lost.
There was the threat before the Gulf War that Iraq would invade Saudi Arabia. Do you think that the Bush administration was worried that Iraq might invade Saudi Arabia and take over the military base there that the United States had so much invested in?
I think the United States felt that we could respond quickly, but if Saddam Hussein had crossed the border, we could lose two of the biggest command and control centers to Saddam Hussein quickly. He wouldn't be able to use them against us immediately because we could short out the wiring and we could essentially prevent him from doing it. But it would give him a foothold and would make it much harder for him to dislodge him. So I think our sense was that we had to go in massively. We couldn't go in a token way. That if we went in a token way, we did fear the possibility that he would come in, seize some territory, and be very hard to dislodge.
So what was the agreement between the United States and the Saudis about who would use the system and when? Who had rights to it?
Well, there's no question that the Saudis own the system. And the Saudis have the right to use it in any way that they see fit.
Do they have to get American permission first?
As a practical matter, they do, in the sense that the software that runs the system can degrade fairly rapidly. And in order to keep it operating over a period of time, in order to buy the other arms equipment and to resupply them, they have to have some American or at least Western cooperation. At one point in the middle of the 1980s, the cooperation broke down. They went to the British and got cooperation from them. But they do require it. The United States can go in only in those circumstances where they're asked in, but the presumption is that if anything threatens the Saudi regime, a conservative regime that's been friendly to the West, if they're threatened by an Islamic neighbor, either by Saddam Hussein or in Iran, that they would invite the United States in to save them. Or if the Soviets began to move in, which of course throughout the 1970s and 1980s was the dominant fear that the United States had. The Soviet Union would move south into the oil regions, seize the oil fields, and open up ports on the Indian Ocean.
Did the military arrangement between the U.S. and the Saudis change after the Gulf War?
Since the Gulf War, the U.S.-Saudi relationship has been, while strong, it's been rocky. What it amounts to is this. We want to continue the relationship. We want to strengthen the relationship and make it very explicit that we will have what amount to bases. We won't want to call them bases. We'll call it pre-positioned equipment. We'll call it kind of permanent training details. We'll call it rotating people in. But it amounts to American personnel and American equipment in the region so that we can get back there quickly. We will, in fact, already be there. The Saudis are willing to do that, but they want the face-saving device of saying that they own it all. And the real loggerheads have come. We say we can't have certain equipment that is only to be used by American troops owned by you people. Even though you say you'll buy it and pre-position it, we want to position it. And as the Saudis have pointed out, once you start down that road, if you have a few American troops there, no matter how few, then next thing you know, you have to have an American support system there. You have to have a commissary. You have to have certain equipment. Then you need people to protect that equipment and that commissary. And the next thing you know, the presence grows and it becomes a different type of arrangement. So there's been this delicate negotiation back and forth, and it continues to go back and forth. I mean, I think recently it's been on the wane. There's been difficulty in getting the Saudis to agree to allow the Americans to have all the things that they want to have and own in the region. On the other hand, the basic intent, the intent of having a mutual defense agreement, is absolutely there and continues to be there.
What do you think the implications of this military arrangement between the U.S. and the Saudis? What are the implications of that for future conflicts in the Middle East?
What this arrangement does is it ties us to a particular partnership and to a particular almost, you could almost say, faction in the Middle East in a way that's unique. We're already tied to Israel, and we've had those ties over a long period of time, and they're not likely to change dramatically. But within the Arab world, we've pretended not to have ties. We've been friendlier to conservative Arab states and conservative Islamic states than to others. But in this region, we're now tied to a particular faction, if you will, to the richest oil nation in the world, but to a particular group of people. And I think that begins to constrain our options in the future. Most importantly, it changes the way the United States deals with the region, because Congress has really not been involved as a full partner in this. This should have been a treaty. There are a number of people I talked to on Capitol Hill that think, while they know the individual parts of it, it's never been presented to them the way it should have been presented to them. It's never been presented to them as a mutual defense treaty. On the other hand, the Saudis are absolutely adamant. They will not allow this to become public and allow it to be voted upon and have the possible humiliation of the American Congress, who they consider to be dominated by supporters of Israel, vote it down. They don't want that. So one of the things that this arrangement does is it kind of slips us into a new era of executive congressional relations, in which the United States becomes not a government under the constitutional system that we've grown up with, of separate branches of government, but where the executive is totally dominant in this one area of foreign affairs, and the Congress completely backs away.
When the United States was able to use this elaborate, already created command and control system, wasn't there any kind of confusion or surprise back home here that, like, where did the system come from? How did it exist?
Remarkably enough, even though certain generals and military figures, when they got there, said, gee, we're really surprised at how sophisticated the equipment is in Saudi Arabia, the press didn't really pick up on it, because the press didn't really get around in Saudi Arabia. They were so controlled by the military, they never got a good overview. They might get to one base. And there were constantly press accounts about, gee, it's interesting, there's a very sophisticated base out here in the middle of the Saudi desert that we didn't know about. I mean, in one place, the King Khalid military city was a city that was put together from scratch, that cost something like $9 billion to put all the infrastructure in. It just was built from nothing. The press really didn't understand the overall system. They never were allowed to add it up. Secondly, when the United States got there, one portion of the system, the kind of final linkage for it, wasn't completed, and the United States had to bring in some of its own equipment and put it in place. And so a lot of what the press was thinking was United States equipment, because they knew the United States had brought in some of this C-cubed I equipment, this command, control, communications, and intelligence equipment, was in fact Saudi equipment. The press didn't recognize the extent to which the high-tech portions of what we used to fight there were really belonged to the Saudis and not to the United States.
The big story this week is in Madrid, where for the first time representatives of the Arab countries, of the Palestinians, and Israel are sitting down together for a peace conference. Does your story about the secret military arrangement between the United States and the Saudis affect your interpretation of President Bush's motives for working so hard to pull off this peace conference?
I think the motives of the United States government for trying to get peace in the region are similar to the motives for wanting to put this system into place, but I don't think the system propels them in a particular direction. I think it's an indication, the ability of the Bush administration to bring players to the table is partially, though, a reflection of the fact that by working through the Saudis and having a close relationship with the Saudis, the Bush administration has had more clout in the Arab world they might otherwise have had. The Saudis are the major players. They're the ones with the money. They're the ones that have funded the PLO over the years and pulled out their support from the PLO when the PLO backed Saddam Hussein. So as the equation changed, Saudi Arabia and the United States moved in the same direction, and I think that committed George Bush to try to get something done with that clout while he had it.
Okay, one last question. Part of the original rationale for the American participation in the creation of this military base in Saudi Arabia was that we wanted to be able to have a military presence in the Middle East in case the Soviets tried to take over the oil wells. Well, the Cold War is over. What's the rationale for keeping the base up now?
The rationales for keeping it are the logic is much the same, that we have to protect the oil and that we want to be in the dominant, the catbird seat if there's a difficulty or conflict in the region. The rationale for the degree of sophistication of the system really isn't there anymore because we're not likely to fight the Soviets or a sophisticated adversary in that region. And right now, it's overkill, and I think we saw it in the Gulf War. We saw that we were so dominant over Iraq, we just squelched them, and we can do that, I think, to Iran or to any other threat in the region. So the fact of the matter is, I think the system's as large as it's going to get to be, and the rationale has disappeared for making it any larger, or perhaps even for maintaining it at the same size.
Have you gotten denials across the board from the administration about this?
In my private conversations, I've gotten very high-level confirmations at the level of, one level away from the secretarial level. I have yet to find anybody at cabinet level who will confirm this, even privately to me. And Secretary of Defense Richard Cheney has gone out of his way to deny that such an arrangement exists, although he does it in language that he's not likely to get trapped by.
Such as?
Well, what he says is that the notion that there's an agreement for us to go in and defend Saudi Arabia if they're under attack from any source is not true. And I think that's right. We have a gentleman's agreement to go in and defend Saudi Arabia against threats when they call us in. It's not an automatically invoked agreement. If they're attacked by some internal faction or whatnot, we're not obliged to go in and defend them. He's given essentially non-denial denials.
So if the Saudis were attacked, are we obliged to go in and defend them now?
If the Saudis are attacked and ask us to come in, we're obliged to go in and defend them. Absolutely.
So what might that mean to our future?
It means we better hope Saudi Arabia doesn't get into difficulty because we're going to be fighting another Gulf War.
Well, Scott Armstrong, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Scott Armstrong is founder of the National Security Archives. His story on the secret military arrangement between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia is in the November-December issue of Mother Jones magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.